Thank you very much. Some people may say those are opposing views. I don't. I think they're different views, but it's important to look at an area that, like I say, has become bordering on ubiquitous. But they're both important things we have to consider. Well, we've got this tremendous voice, but how do we make sure that we don't damage people inappropriately, and that where we feel that we have been damaged, or where there is, we have a personal feeling that we want to be forgotten, that we do have that. So I'm going to open it up for questions now. And I have one mic here, and I assume there's another one around, floating around the room. But
well, I just took mine off.
Okay. Okay. Many questions? Okay.
Yeah, I enjoyed both presentations. I just had a question for Jui. Okay, thank you. I didn't butcher that. So with the advent of these new social networks through which people's opinions can be distributed very rapidly, does that have an impact on the relevance or the credibility of, if you want to call them this, elite opinions? So, for example, you have the site Rotten Tomatoes, where critics are allowed to come on, they distribute their opinions, and it reaches a, I think, a far wider audience than they might have otherwise. And sometimes it's created like these mini controversies around, you know, what score does it get, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the only forum I can think of where you see professional critics, if you want to call them that, assemble with any kind of force on the internet. And I think this could also be applied to academia, although I haven't quite made that connection also, and the kind of rise, if you want, of, you know, novice opinions, and whether or not that's a good thing. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to that in your search.
Do I need to use a mic? Maybe
I'll
just use that. Yeah. So I think that's a really important question, right? So expert opinion versus consumer opinion, and when do each of them matter? I personally have not done research on that, but I've talked to a lot of, in my conversations with people, we've really, and I even talked to Howard about that a little bit before this conversation. It seems like in context where it's a very specific context where tastes matter a lot, expert opinions are quite important. But if you're trying in discovery, it's sort of the democratization of the consumer opinions is where that's important. So I think you were giving an example earlier about drum sets, right, or drumsticks, right? And so that's something that not a lot of people have expertise on that topic. And so in that context, it's very important that you actually talk to somebody who has expertise on that. I think in other contexts, we see that consumer opinions are actually mattering more. Nielsen actually did a survey in the last several years. They've done a survey that says that consumer word of mouth is more important than any other opinion or way of finding out about a product than so consumer word of mouth is what's the most important in terms of making a decision. Yeah. I hope that was.
Oh, absolutely. Further questions? Let me get you the microphone.
David Sobel, Government of Ontario. You just mentioned something that piqued my interest, and that is consumer word of mouth is the most powerful way of sharing. Does that also count for word of mouth online, or is it actual word of mouth?
That's
it's both.
Okay. Yeah. So that's an interesting question. I don't actually study face-to-face word of mouth because I'm in technology, and so this doesn't. But what's interesting is a lot of the word of mouth studies have become all about online word of mouth because it's actually measurable. We can actually trace how information spreads through a network or from a review to a sale. I can't speak to offline word of mouth, to be honest with you.
That the Government of Ontario operates through the Consumer Protection Act?
No, I am not.
Okay, well, maybe we could talk about that later.
Okay,
thanks.
Perfect.
Thank you. I guess this is a question that either of you could answer. You referred in a lot of your examples, Jui, to cases where perhaps consumers had either intentionally or inadvertently, right, made comments about a business that perhaps were not true or for reasons other than commenting on their products. And that's very empowering, right, for consumers to have this voice, but it also can be very damaging and perhaps unfair. And the Starbucks example, as you said, it looked bad, but then maybe it served their purposes. So I don't know, when we're thinking about the droit à l'oubli, are we thinking about it only from the perspective of the individual, or do we also think that there should be some reciprocal right for, right? Bad things that were said at one point about a particular company should be, I mean, you can't imagine erasing them because it would be notorious, but to a certain extent, do we see it? Est-ce que c'est les deux parties qui peuvent en profiter?
I'm sorry, we'll answer in French because it's hard for me in English. Moi, j'étudie évidemment la protection des consommateurs et non pas la protection des entreprises. Mais ce que j'ai fait remarquer dans mon exposé, là, c'est que Google manipule actuellement les résultats de recherche, par exemple, en matière de propriété intellectuelle. Puis on a vu d'autres exemples, par exemple, en Turquie, par exemple, Google a retiré des résultats de recherche qui portaient atteinte au président, par exemple, pour pouvoir demeurer en affaires dans ce pays-là. La tendance qu'on remarque, puis il y a une certaine iniquité actuellement envers les consommateurs, à mon sens, en matière d'oubli sur Internet. Parce que d'un côté, on dirait que les grandes corporations ou les gouvernements parviennent dans certaines circonstances à faire retirer des résultats de recherche. Mais les consommateurs qui, eux, n'ont pas des moyens très importants, eux n'ont pas ce droit-là face aux entreprises. Donc, ça laisse une désagréable impression qu'il y a un déséquilibre, en fait, entre les entreprises, entre les gouvernements puis les consommateurs. Donc, il y a deux avenues possibles. Soit que Google ne plie plus devant les gouvernements, ne plie plus devant les grandes entreprises et fait vraiment un recensement totalement objectif de ce qu'il y a sur Internet. Ou bien, si on plie devant les entreprises, on devrait aussi accorder les mêmes droits aux consommateurs aussi. Donc, là, si on parle plus de petites entreprises qui subissent des commentaires désobligeants. Écoutez, j'ai pas beaucoup de solutions à cet égard-là. Ce que je mentionne, par exemple, puis je crois que Joey l'a peut-être évoqué aussi dans sa présentation, c'est que puis c'est le Bureau de la concurrence qui est sorti récemment là-dessus, d'ailleurs, puis on a fait une recherche aussi par le passé chez Options Consommateurs là-dessus, c'est qu'une grande proportion des commentaires en ligne sont faux et ils sont pas le fait d'individus, mais ils sont le fait d'entreprises de toute façon. Donc, c'est pas nécessairement se protéger contre des individus isolés que les entreprises devraient faire. C'est souvent les commentaires désobligeants qu'une entreprise va recevoir, même une petite entreprise, peut venir de son concurrent, le commerçant d'à côté, par exemple, qui écrit des faux commentaires en ligne. Puis à ce moment-là, mais c'est de la diffamation, puis il s'agit de régler ça entre entreprises avec une bonne vieille poursuite civile.
Just a couple of questions. With respect to the social media side of things, I know I kind of draw a distinction between the social media platforms like Facebook and so on, and the ones that are specifically consumer-oriented. I just make like a fundamental distinction there. Facebook is a social platform for which consumer things can happen. Like, for example, someone on Facebook could decide to promote a particular product because they just think it's fantastic, and through their networks or whatever. But when you get to the consumer sites, like Yelp or whatever, they have one purpose and one purpose only. It's only for consumer information. So I do draw kind of a tighter definition around that. But what is interesting is how these non-commercial sites can be used for commercial and consumer purposes. Like somebody on YouTube can end up being very, very popular just by being on YouTube, and then it ends up they're actually getting some money from or free goods from, and so suddenly, okay, what is the nature of that relationship? Is it really just a somebody who's got a great, you know, really likes this product, or are they actually a shill for a particular company? Anyway, so that's point number one, is I make a distinction between consumer-oriented by definition and non-consumer-oriented social media sites. Second thing is, I'm interested to hear both of your thoughts, both of your opinions on the role of standards in this area. So not law, but standards. And I'm thinking, for example, with respect to the online consumer reviews, there's actually a standard that's being developed, an ISO standard that's being developed in this area. Matter of fact, Howard Dean is the chair of that particular group, and I'm a member of it. But I'm interested to hear your thoughts on what, if any, do you think a role can be played for a standard like that? And then on the privacy side, we know that in Canada we have a federal law that was based on a voluntary code and standard. So I'm interested just more generally from the two of you, what role you think standards can play given the fact that these media sites, social media sites or commercial consumer review sites, et cetera, tend to not stay within any particular country's borders. So is there a role there for standards? Thank you.
I can't answer at all. But, concernant les standards en matière de protection de la vie privée, effectivement, ça a joué un rôle important. Là, le code, la loi fédérale est basée sur un code, là, sur des standards qui ont été développés dans les années 80-90 par l'OCDE, finalement, qui ont été intégrés au Canada. Donc, moi, je ne suis pas un grand partisan des codes volontaires, évidemment, mais ça peut avoir une grande utilité pour atteindre un consensus entre les entreprises et les consommateurs et toutes sortes d'autres intérêts divergents. Donc, souvent c'est... Ben, puis en fait, dans le droit canadien, si on regarde un peu l'historique de la loi fédérale, c'est un peu ça que ça l'a servi, hein. Il y a eu un consensus qui a été établi par rapport aux standards, puis ensuite, ben, la loi est devenue obligatoire. Et si tout le monde s'entend sur un standard, pourquoi ne pas le rendre obligatoire? Et pour ce qui est du futur, évidemment, il y a un gros défi de coordination internationale, là, comme vous avez soulevé. Puis effectivement, oui, des codes volontaires pour s'entendre à l'international sur certaines notions. Puis ça, c'est particulièrement vrai en matière de droit à l'oubli, parce que, puis on le voit ça, hein, parce que le droit à l'oubli actuellement qui est en œuvre en Europe fonctionne juste en Europe. Donc si on va sur Google.com, si on va sur Google dans un autre pays, ben les résultats n'ont pas été retirés. C'est vraiment juste pour les Européens. Donc oui, il y a un gros effort de coordination internationale à faire actuellement en matière de protection de la vie privée en ligne, parce que c'est ingérable autrement. Traditionnellement, les standards développés dans les années 80 et 90 ont eu le grand avantage de donner des lois qui se ressemblent quand même assez dans la plupart des pays, dans la plupart des pays de l'OCDE, à l'exception peut-être des États-Unis, où il n'y a à peu près rien comme loi en matière de protection de la vie privée. Ça a eu comme intérêt, tout le monde s'est entendu, par exemple, pour dire que les droits sur la protection de la vie privée, c'était des droits qui sont non patrimoniaux. Donc, on n'a pas pris la voie patrimoniale, puis on a pris une voie qui insistait sur le consentement, évidemment, avec des différences dans tous les pays. Les standards, comme d'autres façons de faire, pourraient, à mon sens, peut-être débroussailler puis s'entendre sur des grands principes généraux qui pourraient être applicables dans tous les pays par la suite. Je pense que ça pourrait être ça l'utilité. Pour la suite, si Drew a quelque chose à ajouter.
So that I can answer, this is not really my area in particular, so could you explain a little bit more what the standards would do, what the, and then maybe I can comment. Oh. Or the goal, maybe the goal of the...
Yeah,
of the test, yeah.
Well, the goal of the standard is that there's two main problems. One problem is that there can be misinformation put up by consumers or faux consumers. And the other is that from the business side, they might not be doing... whoever is doing the operating the review site might not be doing a good job in terms of how they classify things, et cetera, and all that angle of it. So if there was some standardized way of doing it so that you as a consumer would know, this is how it's done, and so that the information is more reliable, more accessible, more easily usable, all that sort of stuff, our opinion is that would be an improvement, particularly, as I say, for most of these sites, given that they are international in scope. TripAdvisor, you don't really care whether or not somebody's in Germany or they're in Hawaii if they are reviewing that particular hotel located in, you know, Timbuktu. That's what you want to know. Right. So they're kind of by nature international. So right. Is there a role for standard network?
Yeah. I can respond quickly. So without knowing, having looked at the implications of establishing these types of standards before, I could say that, yes, fake reviews, for example, on Amazon, I think 30% of reviews have been shown to be fake. And at the same time, you have management who also doesn't necessarily know how to manage these fake reviews. So something like standards could be useful in that sense. But I also feel that in some ways, word of mouth is changing. The way these reviews are being used is changing. changing. So it's not just written reviews now. It's that social influence on Facebook, for example, is a huge way of spreading information. So how do you actually regulate or how do you create standards for that? So I think it's going beyond the scope of just online reviews. So I think looking at it more broadly is very important too. But yeah, thanks.
Just maybe to continue in the same direction as Kondigan, I don't know one law in the domain of technology which is another mess. Each time we have a new law for a new technology, it's very difficult to apply by the judge. And so I think the view, which is really a kind of Canadian view, and I'm pretty sure that Canada have a place to play on the international forum to promote some kind of standard could be much more efficient law, and particularly in terms of privacy, was the position of European is very different from the North American position. So I think in Quebec we need to be careful, because in some view we have some more connection with Europe, but the law at the end is promoted by the Supreme Court of Canada. The Supreme Court of Canada, and this view is on many points very different from the one we find in Europe. You mentioned the decision of the Supreme Court of Justice in Europe. We clearly explain that the privacy principle is higher of other major principle that the Canadian Charter recognize as the liberty of expression, liberty of information. So in Europe, there is a hierarchy where the privacy is on the top. This is my view of the decisions. And this view is very different from the one we have in Quebec and in Canada. So maybe the more negotiated approach we may find by promoting some kind of standard is the best way to influence, for example, the work of Google. And I just want to finish on that point. Europe love to hate Google because it's American. They do a lot of money. Though it's two major defaults in the European perspective. But the privacy commissioner in Canada succeed to negotiate with them and change their practice just by negotiating. And this is something which is very far from the European perspective, where they prefer to have confront the position and to use formal law with formal jurisprudence. So we have a Canadian perspective. I think it's important to promote it and to express this distinction.
Sorry for the long. Thank you. No, that's what we're looking for. Less.
Maybe just running on Vincent's point, too. Obviously, the role of sort of models. So a really good further example, Canadian example, is the privacy by design model that, of course, it came from the Ontario Privacy Commissioner. And that was, again, that was not about law. That was about trying to affect design early on. And that was a very different way to look at it than from a point of view of jurisprudence in the European model. So it's just sort of worthwhile thinking sort of a bit outside the box.
Je vais commenter brièvement sur tout ça. Première chose, c'est vrai, si on prend juste la loi québécoise en matière de protection de la vie privée, c'est tout à fait vrai que cette loi est complètement désuète, à mon sens, et mérite d'être réformée pour tenir compte des nouvelles technologies. Puis c'est vrai que c'est très difficile d'encadrer ces nouvelles technologies-là. La solution, mais c'est souvent passé probablement par une plus grande neutralité technologique, garder quelque chose de neutre technologiquement. Concernant la question là de est-ce que l'approche de la négociation est meilleure que l'approche de la méthode forte, je comprends bien que c'est un peu ça l'opposition qu'on fait ici. Moi, je pense que les deux peuvent fonctionner, c'est-à-dire que dans certains cas, il y a certaines compagnies qui sont très difficiles à faire changer leurs pratiques. Ça prend des lois qui sont capables, qui ont assez de dents pour fonctionner efficacement. Mais je pense qu'aussi fonctionner par privacy par design, partir en amont, puis essayer de négocier le plus possible avec les entreprises pour obtenir des résultats. Ça peut fonctionner dans certaines circonstances. Si on parle de l'affaire, par exemple, de 2014, là, sur les renseignements sensibles qui étaient collectés par Google, effectivement, Google a changé ses pratiques. Mais je suis pas convaincu des résultats que ça a donné. Je crois qu'il y a encore des renseignements sensibles qui sont recueillis par Google. Puis souvent, les résultats qu'on peut obtenir par la négociation sont peut-être pas aussi probants que ce qu'on peut obtenir avec une décision que dans Google Spain où là, on parle d'un véritable droit qui a été créé basé sur la directive et qui fonctionne très bien. Qui fonctionne très bien, je pourrais pas me permettre de juger ça, mais du moins qui a été très populaire parce qu'il y a 350 000 personnes qui ont fait la demande. Donc, c'est peut-être un peu de tout. C'est privacy par design, négociation, puis peut-être aussi des lois qui sont capables de permettre aux autorités, dans certains cas, de mettre en œuvre certaines dispositions pour protéger les consommateurs.
More a comment about our research on demographics and consumer interest in our consumer beware list. I think one of the things that we're finding is that it's people over the age of 45 or 50 who care about invasion of privacy and being manipulated on the internet, whereas people under 30, they just expect it. They just expect this is the way of the world. That we find in our demographic data that almost no one under the age of 30 contacts us or files a complaint. Because they just expect that this is how the world works. This is the way the marketplace works now. Whereas people over the age of particularly 55, 60, they are the ones who file written complaints, who are very upset that they're being manipulated by misleading advertising. And I guess one of the things that I'd be interested in researching further is this a generational perspective that is in some way slipping away, and that young people who grew up with the internet, who did not know a world before the internet, just expect that this is the way the world works.
J'imagine qu'on n'a plus beaucoup de temps, mais je vais répondre juste rapidement. Le fatalisme là, en matière de vie privée, je ne suis pas tellement fan de cette question-là. Je ne crois pas que c'est impossible de protéger la vie privée des gens sur Internet. Il y a tout à fait moyen de le faire. Ça, c'est souvent les entreprises qui vont dire qu'il n'y a simplement pas moyen de le faire, tandis qu'ils ont simplement modifié leurs algorithmes, ont simplement modifié leurs paramètres pour cesser de recueillir certaines données, tout simplement. Donc, c'est tout à fait possible de protéger la vie privée en ligne. Deuxième aspect, l'aspect plus générationnel, les jeunes ne se préoccupent pas de leur vie privée, tout ça, c'est une fausse conception qu'on a. Les jeunes se préoccupent de leur vie privée, mais la perçoivent différemment. Puis là-dessus, je vous référerai aux travaux de Dana Boyd qui a fait de très bonnes choses en matière de sociologie là, sur la perception des gens en matière de vie privée, qui démontre qu'en fait, c'est une fausse idée là, qu'on se fait que les jeunes ne se préoccupent pas de leur vie privée.
So, thank you both very much. I'm sure there are more questions, but we'll have time afterwards.